This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. What's your dream job? Chances are that over the years, the answer to that question has changed, probably quite a bit. Those are the questions that Dr. Kevin Hoff tries to answer in his new research paper in the Journal of Career Assessment. It's called Dream Jobs and Employment Realities: How Adolescents' Career Aspirations Compare to Labor Demands and Automation Risks. Dr. Kevin Hoff is a professor of industrial organizational psychology at the University of Houston. I asked who they spoke to in this study.
Yeah, so we surveyed a bunch of adolescents. So there was over 3,000 adolescents from 42 U.S. states. And we have some information about their background in terms of their gender, age, and ethnicity. And what's most important for the study was we looked at their career aspiration. So just a simple question of basically what is their dream job? And then we coded those responses. So when kids report that, they report all different things. And of course, some of them take the opportunity to make a joke about various things. But we coded all the ones that we could into standardized occupations. And then we could get information about the interests and the educational requirements and also the automation risks of these different careers.
And why did you take on this topic? What brought the interest?
Yeah, so several different things. I have always been interested in career development, and I worked in a career center as part of grad school. And one of the things that really stood out to me when I was doing that career counseling is that there's oftentimes these tricky situations where a client in this case is a student, will come in and be really interested in medical school or something else that kind of is inconsistent with the information that we can see about them, at least in terms of, like, for example, with medical school, you do need a good GPA in college. And at that career center, we can see people's GPAs as they're coming in. And so this kind of tricky situation where you want to help students ultimately achieve their goals and their dream jobs, but you also want to be realistic with them. And there's kind of a balance between encouraging them to have ambitious career goals, but also, like, being real with them in terms of what the labor market, how many of these jobs exist in the labor market, and what are the educational requirements for those jobs. And the second reason is that there really just isn't a lot of research on the labor market side in terms of the interests and educational requirements of different jobs and how many of those jobs there are.
You mentioned one thing before is the risk of automation on a job. It's interesting. Adolescents are actually thinking that far ahead that this job won't be replaced by a robot.
So I don't think most of them are. We derived information about the automation risks from a previous study that estimated it based on a couple of different factors, which was largely due to how easy it would be for technology to do the core tasks of different occupations, and both in terms of current technology and also expected advances in the future. But that is an interesting question in terms of to what extent are you thinking about these sorts of issues in terms of their dream jobs. And I think partly our study indicates that they're not thinking a whole lot about them, at least as teenagers.
So what did you, I see you broke this up into males and females. What did you find the younger males and females were looking at? And how did that change when you looked at the older males and females?
Yeah, good question. It certainly, I think those two categories, so age was important, and then also gender. And there are fairly large gender differences in terms of the careers that youth aspire to. So for females, the most popular occupations were doctors, veterinarians, and teachers. And increasingly with age, nurses was also a very popular one. And for males, being a professional athlete was overwhelmingly the most popular career aspiration. But age was certainly important. So among 13-year-old boys, over 30% reported wanting to be a professional athlete as their career goal. But by the time they were 18, it was only down to 5%. So
reality has a way of setting in, doesn't it?
Exactly, yes. So athletes was probably the most striking example, but really the same general trend applied for most occupations, where there was, at the younger ages, there's a smaller subset of very well-known occupations that are oftentimes things that youth are exposed to either in school or on the media. So that could be on TV or the internet. Those really just dominated what kids are aspiring to. So among 13-year-olds, the top 10 occupations accounted for over 60% of all aspirations. So there's not a whole lot of variability in terms of youth career aspirations at age 13. But by the time they're 18, it was down to about 40%. So we are seeing reality sets in a number of different ways across adolescence.
So not too many 13-year-olds are saying they want to be a CPA.
No. And I think actually that CPA was, I don't think there was a single, so of these over 3,000 aspirations, there may have been one or two people who wanted to be accountants, but that the broader category of accounting, which is conventional interests, were extremely underrepresented. If youth aren't interested in those sorts of careers, that's fine, because we know that people are going to work in them anyway. But we didn't really expect there to be such a striking gap, because conventional interest jobs account for over 20% of the labor market and less than 1% of career aspirations.
I bet you those kids who did say they wanted to be an accountant have parents that are accountants.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good guess, certainly.
How do you hope this research might be used?
Yeah, so I think a couple different ways. And I think there's several different implications that have emerged from our research and from similar studies. So we do see this, really high concentration of career aspirations for a small subset of occupations. And obviously, 30% of males aren't going to become professional athletes. So what I think is the biggest implication is building better career education in schools and making that more of the norm rather than the exception. And I think career education can come in a variety of different ways, but kind of the overall goal should just be to expose youth to more careers and to different careers, and to do it in a way that actually connects to their developing values and the things that they care about in terms of their peers. And so that youth aren't solely reliant on the media to gather information about what people do in different jobs, because we know that the media is not super realistic, and what people see on TV is not necessarily what people do in different jobs, and also only covers a very small subset of the different jobs that exist.
I see you talk about positive and negative outcomes for careers. Talk about what you mean by that.
Yeah, so there's different measures anyway of indicating like what's a positive or negative outcome. And with career development, I think that there's subjective and objective outcomes. And those would be subjective is people's self-reports of how satisfied they are in their job and with their choice of a career or their career progression in general. And there's also objective outcomes, which are things that we often think about in terms of like financial success or having a leadership position. And I think one thing to point out is that not everyone wants a job necessarily that makes a ton of money. Certainly that's income is one of the biggest factors that people think about, but a lot of people are very satisfied and fulfilled in careers that don't necessarily pay as much, but they fit their values in other sorts of ways. So ultimately, I think what in terms of career aspirations, there's also positive and negative outcomes of our findings, which is that generally speaking, that youth are aspiring to more prestigious careers that indicate a lot of ambition on the part of youth, but not necessarily a lot of knowledge about what's actually required to get into those occupations. So the positive outcomes would be that even if youth are aspiring to a really ambitious career, so for example, if I want to be a doctor, and as I go along in school and realize that maybe I don't necessarily love those difficult chemistry classes that I'm taking, you know, my first semester of college, that I still might end up doing something, a really important career in the medical field that just doesn't necessarily require going to 5 years of med school. So that would be a positive of having an ambitious career aspiration that doesn't necessarily work out. But the negatives are also that in some cases too, you're starting school and pursuing something and investing money in something that is not necessarily realistic, and potentially your time could be better served searching for something that is a better fit in terms of ability or interest.
And you did some work with the Occupational Information Network. What is that network?
Yeah, so the Occupational Information Network, which is often called ONET for short, is the U.S. Department of Labor's primary source of occupational data. So it's a really amazing website, and it has a ton of utility for research and then also for career exploration. But basically what it is, they have over 900 different occupation categories, and they have, for each of those occupations, they have a ton of different information about what it is that people actually do in that career, and then also the personality, interests, values, the skills that are required, the average wages. And we also use estimates about the automation risks from these coded O-net occupations.
So the bottom line for this is it's great to have a dream job, but you ought to have a backup plan too.
I think, yeah, that's certainly one of the bottom lines. And again, I think that the tricky thing is the balancing between wanting to encourage ambition, and you know, no one wants to be the teacher or counselor or parent who discourages someone from pursuing their dream job. But at the same time, I think you can also be real with them and incorporate information about the labor market and about educational requirements, and really set people up with a better understanding of what it would actually take to have that dream job.
Dr. Kevin Hoff is professor of industrial organizational psychology at the University of Houston. His new research paper appears in the Journal of Career Assessment. Still to come, as variants of the coronavirus continue to appear, scientists working to identify them are trying to keep up. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Late last year, a clinically significant SARS-CoV-2 variant with an increased transmission rate was identified in the United Kingdom. Since then, it has been quickly spreading around the world. So far, these COVID variants appear to be detectable by commonly used laboratory tests and hopefully will not present a diagnostic challenge for clinical labs. But as the COVID-19 pandemic continues, many health officials feel that more of these clinically significant variants will pop up. An opinion piece in the May 2021 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry proposes steps clinical laboratories can take to deal with emerging SARS-CoV-2 variants. The lead author of that paper is Dr. Laura Filkins, an assistant professor of pathology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center and director of microbiology at Children's Health in Dallas. I asked Dr. Filkins, just what is a variant of a virus and how common are they?
A variant of a virus is a virus whose genome sequence is different than that of a reference virus. So in the case of SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes coronavirus disease 2019 or COVID-19, we usually use one of the earliest sequenced viruses from a patient in Wuhan at the end of 2019 as being the reference. Therefore, any change in the virus or anything different from that original reference is considered a variant. And at this point in the pandemic, essentially every virus of SARS-CoV-2 is a variant. So it's very common. And I should also say that variants are not unique to SARS-CoV-2. Every virus and every organism has variants.
So how are such variants detected and identified?
Good question. So variants are identified a little bit differently than most of our standard laboratory testing for SARS-CoV-2. So to back up a step, most of our laboratory-based tests that we perform to diagnose SARS-CoV-2 infection are amplification-based assays, like PCR. And we can determine, yes, a sample contains SARS-CoV-2, or no, SARS-CoV-2 is not detectable. But to identify a new variant, or even a known variant, PCR isn't quite enough. So we use whole genome sequencing for this. We typically use a next-generation sequencing platform, and then pair that with bioinformatics tools. And really amazingly, with some of these newer technologies, we can actually identify variants within potentially a few hours after collecting a sample. Now, realistically, with the workflows in most laboratories, that timeline is usually closer to a couple of days or maybe even a week. But still, that's within a turnaround time that could be clinically actionable.
Do all viral variants impact clinical conditions and/or public health?
Actually, no. Many viral variants appear to have no effect on clinical or public health. Some variants actually make the virus less fit, and those typically don't stay around for very long. But some variants, of course, do have a significant clinical impact. And the variants that we are most alert for in the lab and in the clinical setting would be those variants that appear to affect viral fitness, either by changing its replication or its infectivity, transmission, potentially even host interactions that could lead to more severe disease. And we also look for viruses that are more resistant to the therapies that we have available, or potentially allow the virus to evade a patient's immune response after vaccination. So to address these different degrees of impact, we use a classification system, which includes variants of interest, meaning those we're studying, and variants of concern, meaning those with mutations that appear to confer benefits to the virus that are likely to impact clinical or public health. And currently, there are four variants of concern that are recognized by the World Health Organization. Those go by both a few different scientific lineage-based names and also by, more recently, their WHO label, which is Alpha, Beta, Gamma, and Delta. You've probably heard of in the news recently. And then the US CDC actually includes two additional variants of concern, both of which are Epsilon.
So could the presence of viral variants in our population impact the ability for labs to detect COVID-19 infection?
Yes, variation of the virus can impact the ability for us to detect SARS-CoV-2 using our current clinical diagnostic tests. And this is actually one of my greatest fears as a laboratory director. The primary concern is that variation could lead to false negative results if the wrong combination of mutations occurs. And of course, the risk with false negatives is that we may then have a patient who alters their behavior because of that negative result. And this could mean acting differently in public or even in the private setting. Another potential impact of that is using less PPE or protective equipment in the healthcare setting. And this would be done based on trusting that the patient really does not have SARS-CoV-2 infection. So in order to avoid these potential false results, there are a few things that in the laboratory we can do. The first is to consistently monitor for reports of local variants and even potentially global variants that haven't entered your local population yet. And we want to make sure that our COVID tests in the lab can detect those variants. So how we can go about this, first, always review the manufacturer's reports to see if there are any predicted performance issues that the manufacturer is reporting. Of course, it's a little bit challenging because many of the designs of commercial assays are proprietary, and we really do rely on the manufacturers for that. But for tests whose design is public, labs can perform their own in silico prediction to determine if the reagents are anticipated to bind and then detect the virus variants. Ideally, labs would go one step further whenever possible, and if there are available reagents to do so. And beyond just in silico predictions, we would like to test in vitro whether or not our assays can detect variants of virus. So we can use either whole virus or recombinant virus that mimics variants and determine if our platforms qualitatively can detect the virus and if there's any impact on limit of detection.
Is there a need for broad clinical application for variant identification?
This is a challenging question to answer because the word need carries some degree of opinion with it. But currently, I think it's fair to say that sequencing is imperative to public health. However, clinical care is independent of variant identification in most cases at the moment. And really knowing if the patient is infected with SARS-CoV-2 or not, but not necessarily knowing which variant, will drive the majority of clinical decision making. On the public health side, though, the amount of virus sequencing that has been performed even in the first half of 2021 is exponentially increased compared to that earlier in the pandemic. And monitoring changing epidemiology will be crucial over the coming months. However, sequencing is resource intensive. And I think it's unrealistic at this point to expect routine variant identification for all positive samples. On the other hand, screening for sequence determinants may become more routine as we progress through the pandemic. And there are a few potential clinical applications for this, such as detecting known variants that could have reduced susceptibility to monoclonal antibody therapies, differentiating between persistent infection in a patient from a single virus versus reinfection, or potentially detecting genetic changes that confer resistance or reduce susceptibility after vaccination.
So how can an individual laboratory test for known variants?
As we've discussed, whole genome sequencing is the primary method. And to confirm that a virus belongs to a given lineage, let's say B117 or the alpha variant, the entire genome must be determined. However, for labs that don't plan to perform whole genome sequencing, there are several screening methods that I alluded to. And these methods usually look for a change or multiple changes that are consistent with a given lineage, but not definitive for that lineage. So some screening methods include partial genome or partial gene sequencing. We also have several amplification-based methods, and these are typically assays that are designed so that the primers of the probes positively bind to a change in sequence that's consistent with that variant. Although we can also use the reverse, which is to have a dropout of a signal when a variant occurs. We can do MELT curve analysis to predict sequence changes within an amplicon. And there are also a few commercially designed and manufactured assays that have been built to detect known sequence variation, most of them geared towards screening for the common variants of concern currently circulating. I should note, though, that the commercial assays that currently are available do not have emergency use authorization from the FDA for variant detection.
Well, it appears then there are increasingly available approaches to detect both novel and known variants. For laboratories that don't plan on performing whole genome sequencing or implementing screening assays specific to known nucleotide polymorphisms, are there other approaches to monitor potential variants?
Yes, there are several things that labs can do to monitor for variants without implementing additional testing. My first recommendation is to monitor your institutional positivity rates and continuously compare those rates to local, regional, or even state-level epidemiology. The goal of this comparative monitoring would be to look for an anomaly. So, for example, if your institution's positivity rates typically coincide with that of the county, but then suddenly drop or spike relative to your comparator, your county, then that would be an opportunity for investigation. And beyond lab results, there are some clinical scenarios that could be indicators for further assessment. This usually requires collaboration between infection prevention and control, maybe your occupational health teams or your clinical teams. And in these situations, what we look for are patients that merit further investigation when they have a positive sample. This could be positive samples from a patient who's fully vaccinated or a patient who has been positive for a very prolonged period of time. And then finally, labs can consider reaching out to their public health labs to inquire about what the public health needs are. For example, you know, maybe your public health lab is looking for a subset of samples from multiple different hospitals. And I would just encourage that you ask your public health lab, what is it that you can do to help facilitate their surveillance effort?
Dr. Laura Filkins is an assistant professor of pathology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center and director of microbiology at Children's Health in Dallas. Her opinion piece on COVID-19 variants appears in the May 2021 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. A good way to fight all forms of the coronavirus is making sure we have good, quality, safe hospitals. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Hospital safety and quality are a pressing concern. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Linda Dynan, professor of economics, takes an economic outlook on these issues.
Most of us think of hospitals as places we go in order to get well when we are too ill to recover from illness or injury at home. Researchers from many disciplines and healthcare providers are striving to make sure that is true. I'm an economist who studies how to improve healthcare, which means either we can improve access to and the quality of healthcare at the same cost, or maintain access and quality but produce these at lower cost. In 2000, a report documented the alarming incidence and cost of preventable adverse events, or patient safety events, in America's hospitals, reporting that as many as 98,000 people die in hospitals every year as a result of preventable medical errors. Since then, government agencies and hospitals have worked to measure medical error and provide incentives for hospitals to minimize these events. This is where my research comes in. What types of policies are effective in reducing medical error? What types of investments by hospitals lead to improvements in patient safety? Information technology, nurse training, empowering frontline caretakers to signal problems. Once we know what works, how do we get hospitals to adopt these systems and processes? How do we make these changes sustainable? Well, what have we learned? Well, we can do better. We have seen improvement in many measures of hospital quality. Preliminary results indicate increased expenditure on the education and training of nursing staff and on data processing produce improvements in patient safety. Context matters. That is, each hospital is different and quality improvement efforts need to be tailored to each environment. Incentives also matter. Government policies related to value-based care and non-payment encourage hospitals to change behaviors to improve outcomes. Healthcare workers are motivated to do the right thing, but doing the right thing is often costly, and we have much more to learn.
That was Linda Dynan of Northern Kentucky University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.